Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is at 12:02 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 18th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Now, I thought we'd kick off this week with this chart of the MSCI Emerging Market Currency Index. And one thing that is very clear is that emerging market currencies did extraordinarily well in the period from 1997 all the way up to the peak in 2011. And since then, it's been pretty unremarkable. So there really hasn't been much to talk about in terms of emerging market currency performance over the course of the last decade. So the big question then is, are we going to see another decade of this underperformance by emerging market currencies, or are we approaching the end of this very lengthy, rangy phase overall? It's a big question. Of course, one of the answers is going to be, well, what exactly is in this index? And the answer is, it's not as widely populated by emerging market currencies as one might hope for. In fact, it follows the country weights of the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. So that's 40% in China, 12% in South Korea, 12 and a bit in Taiwan, India at 8%, Brazil at less than 5%, and the rest at 20%. So that's obviously then going to have an awfully big weighting in China. So that is also reflective of just how much of a weighting China has in the emerging markets ETF. What's particularly interesting as well is that the emerging markets ETF has been largely range bound since 2011 as well. In fact, it's been range bound since about 2008. So what we can therefore conclude, it's further evidence that international investors are really interested in emerging markets when the currency is on their side, because there is this widespread perception that emerging market currencies tend to be very volatile. And if one doesn't take account of that when investing in countries, then all of the total return can get eaten up by that currency market volatility. Unfortunately, that is the perception of the way that people think. It doesn't necessarily gel with what the reality is, because just the fact that emerging market currencies generally have gone sideways rather than trended lower on aggregate over this decade, that should be evidence enough that they're not as or that every currency is capable of volatility, not just emerging markets. In fact, I think anyone who has paid any attention to the UK over the course of the last decade and seen the volatility in the pound, or the fact that today what we have is a US government which is actively prosecuting other countries for currency manipulation. I do think that's rather it's a rather odd situation. If we think about the countries that the USA has in fact decided are currency manipulators, then it is a laundry list of countries that have done well as a result of their response to the coronavirus. So, for example, when we think about who are the countries then that have popped up on the USA's list, well, one of them was Taiwan. And I find that rather interesting because the Taiwanese currency is at new recovery highs. It hasn't been this strong since 1997, and it's still trending higher. In fact, if we go all the way back, and unfortunately we just don't get that much history, but it hasn't been this strong, really, in a very long time. And even during the big bull market for Taiwan in the 1980s, and the currency did keep going stronger well after the stock market had peaked, then there is clear scope that we're going to get back into this 26 handle and it may even strengthen further. So obviously Taiwan and the Taiwanese officials have been rather vocal in saying that they're the best judge of where the value of their currency should be, but the currency has been appreciating. There has also been some talk about currency manipulation in Vietnam. But again, here we've had a pattern of performance from Vietnam where they have been devaluing the currency every time they've run into trouble, so that has been an issue. But it has been appreciating of late, and it is in fact back in the region of the peaks for the last 3 years and has rebounded from the lows that were put in all the way back during the teeth of the initial coronavirus panic in March and April. The Vietnamese stock market index has been rebounding, and it is now pushing through to new recovery highs. It's cleared the psychological 1,000 level for the first time in nearly 3 years, and pushing back up towards the highs put in 2007 and again in 2018. So this has been a lengthy period of consolidation from the pullback from the first test of the accelerated peak back in 2007. And it is looking increasingly likely that Vietnam is going to be one of the primary beneficiaries of the rebound in terms of global growth. They've done admirably in terms of containing the threat from the pandemic, and they also have the scope to benefit from offshoring from China. And yet they are on the watch list for currency manipulation. Then when we look at the Indian rupee, India has also been put on the currency manipulators' watch list. Well, India's rupee has been trending downwards for an awfully long time, but there was a period between about 2002 and 2012-13 where it was reasonably steady. And now it is back above its trend mean and has been strengthening really since March of this year. India is benefiting from having a very young population, where there are probably going to be about half of its total population enter the workforce for the first time within the next decade. Then it is on the cusp of a very significant demographic dividend, and they are attempting to put into place the kinds of policies necessary to employ as many of those people as possible. Now, they have so far decided to stay outside the ASEAN trade agreement, so there is still an anti-competitive edge to the way that India is being managed, but they do have a very large domestic population and domestic demand growth driver, so there is potentially the scope that India will try and build out its manufacturing capacity first before entering into trade agreements later. And the more important point, of course, is that of all the countries that are being accused of currency manipulation by the USA, most of them have seen their currencies appreciate relative to the US dollar. Of course, the country that is most often highlighted as a currency manipulator is China. And here also we have the fact that the renminbi has been appreciating pretty much all the time since May of this year. And it is now pausing, but this has been a clear break of the overall weakening bias that had been in place for most of the last 3 or 4 years. The clear break in that trend has definitely signaled that China is willing to allow their currency to appreciate further. Now, there are so many different moving parts to the currency markets, so it's often just simple to ask ourselves, or I think the easiest way is to ask ourselves simple questions. By accusing a large number of countries of currency manipulation, What the USA is in fact doing is saying to the world that they want a weaker currency. Now, no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others. So by becoming increasingly recalcitrant, the USA is increasingly telling the world that they are the country that needs a weaker currency more than everybody else. Well, happiness in the currency markets is having the trend and the central bank on your side. So the US government wants a weaker currency, and the Federal Reserve has been massively increasing the supply of money in the system. They've completely abandoned quantitative tightening, and they have said that they're not going to raise interest rates for years to come. So you certainly have the central bank on your side when it comes to trying to bet against the US dollar. You also have the government and interest rates on one side as well. Then when we think about other countries, well, the countries that have come through the pandemic best are now in a global environment where there is a massive amount of liquidity sloshing around, and it has clearly inflationary potential, and mostly for those countries that have come through the crisis best. So when we had, for example, the Norwegian Central Bank in here today saying that they are not averse to having a stronger currency because a stronger currency would help to dampen down domestic inflationary pressures, well, that's a green light for investors to buy the currency, and particularly against the US dollar, considering that they want a weaker currency. So the best trends, or the most consistent trends in currencies, generally tend to evolve where we can match the strongest against the weakest. And among the stronger currencies at present is the Norwegian crown, because they are at least talking about potentially raising interest rates at sometime next year or the year after. That's a little bit faster than anyone else is talking about potentially doing that. Of course, China's government bond yield is also pricing in the potential that they will have to raise interest rates. Their economy is expected to grow by 8% next year. And China is coming out of the coronavirus in a stronger position overall than most other major economies, and not least because they have not gone for the massive money printing that the USA has, or indeed that Europe has. Most of the support measures that have been put in place have been fiscal, and it has been devolved to the local governments. So there's been a lot of corporate bond issuance, there's been a lot of land sales, and that is also contributing to demand for commodities. So the commodity that is responding most acutely to these developments is copper. And it pushed on to new recovery highs again in here this week. When we look at the LME price for copper, then there are some key levels that tend to pop out. The first is 8,000. Now, I don't have real-time prices for the LME, but I have seen news headlines today that LME copper is through the $8,000 level. But one way or the other, it has clearly broken through the peaks put in 2018. And this has been a really very impressive rebound. One thing that is, I think, particularly relevant is when we look at as much history as we can lay our hands on, we can see that there was a very long base formation, and by and large prices had been dribbling lower for a very long time before the big bull market started in the early 2000s. Since then, prices, even during the big decline in 2008, never pulled back into the base. So the easiest way to define a commodity bull market is an increase in the marginal cost of production. So prices rise enough to encourage new supply into the market. but that new supply that's encouraged into the market has an incrementally higher production price than at the status quo that existed before the new source of demand arrived. And that's exactly what we had with commodities back in the early 2000s, that prices had been in a secular bear market for decades. And with China entering the WTO and then engaging in this extraordinarily large infrastructure build, then this new demand cycle took off, and it took time for new sources of supply to be brought to market. It takes about 10 years to build new major mining projects, and when they opened, then you start to see prices coming back down again. Now the question that investors should be asking is, why are copper prices so firm right now? So is this a recovery scenario similar to what we had in 2008 through 11? And could we therefore anticipate that copper prices will go back to 10,000? Or is this a new secular demand growth driver? And will there have to be another significant new supply investment cycle in order to satiate the massive sources of new demand that are coming into the market? Well, if this is just a rebound like we saw in 2008 through 2011, it would be easy to justify based upon the potential for infrastructure development, for countries to bet everything on reflation, for interest rates to remain low for a prolonged period, for liquidity to remain in the market, for the beginning of inflationary pressures to start to come back. All of that would be justification to see prices push back up towards those peaks put in 2011. However, we do have an additional demand growth driver, and that additional demand growth driver is renewable energy. Whether it is for electric vehicles or whether it is for the chargers necessary to recharge those vehicles, or it's wind, because a 1 megawatt wind turbine requires 3 tons of copper. So these are significant demand growth drivers for copper that really didn't exist back in 2006 through 2010. Of course, we had a phenomenal bull market in renewable energy back in the period when oil prices were doing extraordinarily well. If we go back and look at the performance of the solar ETF, it was trading at extraordinarily high prices, with oil at an extraordinarily high price as well. But what changed in 2018, really I think more like the middle of 2019, was that even though oil prices declined, renewable energy stocks rose. The breaking of that linkage between a complete dependence on high oil prices to justify investment in renewables is a very significant change, because it tells us that on the one hand, the technology is probably good enough. On the other, it's telling us that regulatory environments and perhaps the carbon credit market has also increased to such an extent that it no longer depends upon high oil prices to justify it. Or it may be because there's new technology, and that new technologies are already more efficient than oil prices, and that the tipping point is on the cusp of being approached or overcome. But regardless of whether it is any or all of those potential explanations, the reality is that the reality is that these renewable energy companies are doing better regardless of whether oil prices are going up or down. Of course, this is a very significant development. Solar doesn't necessarily need copper. Wind definitely does. And the wind ETF has done nothing but rally over the course of the last few months. But it's also coming up in an aggressive manner off of depressed levels. And it is still a fraction of where it was trading back during the last really big move on the upside for oil prices. It is worth thinking about what we can anticipate from oil prices. The reality is that with the success of renewables, there is obviously this question about should oil rally further? And I do think it comes back to that basic question about what can we anticipate? Can we anticipate that the rebound that we're getting right now is similar to the rebound that we had in 2008? Or are we looking at a new secular bull market? Well, I think it's hard to make the argument for oil prices as being a new secular bull market for the simple reason that we do not have a new big demand growth driver. What we certainly have is a reflation play. So it could be very similar for oil that we get a rebound similar to what we had in 2008 through 2011 without seeing oil prices break on the upside and trade significantly above $140. I think that is perhaps too much to ask for. The important point with oil is that we really have had a massive supply response. The evolution of shale oil and gas is an absolute game changer in terms of the supply situation. It's turned the world's largest consumer into one of the biggest swing producers. And that is not something that has been repeated in any other major industrial commodity. So we have not had the same kind of massive supply response in copper or the industrial metals that we have had in oil. And that difference is something that probably limits the potential for oil to rally in a very big way. And when I say a big way, I mean that it would break out of this 12-year base formation and then move into another secular bull market where the price could go up 10x, because it went up 10x in the period up from the lows ahead of the big bull market. Prices had got all the way back down to about $10 and then exceeded $100 and then very handily was able to push on even further. So I don't think that oil is at that point yet. We're not at a point where it is logical to anticipate we're going to see oil prices trade up to $1,000 a barrel at any point in the next 20 or even 30 years. But is it possible for oil prices to get back to the $80 to $100 handle or even back up to $120 for a brief period? I think that's quite possible. And certainly the trend of recovery that we're seeing in oil prices right now is going to bring prices back up towards that $80 area, probably over the next 12 months, and then we will probably have a supply response. We're seeing a significant amount of investment in rationalization of the shale sector, where the big companies are buying the smaller companies, and that will reduce the marginal cost of production. It will also allow greater flexibility in terms of bringing supply to market at higher prices. That ability of shale to be the swing producer and with great flexibility in terms of supply relative to price is the defining characteristic of the oil market today, and it is likely to contribute to continued ranging until demand is finally big enough to exceed the ability of shale to cater to that in terms of its elasticity. We're likely to have that range. But when we think about the evolution of copper, then it's a different environment. We're starting to see also that lithium prices have turned the corner, and this is another important trend. This has been a very nice break of trend. It's a clear loss of momentum over most of this year, and we're now starting to see lithium trending higher again from really very depressed levels. When we think about some of the biggest producers, lithium is one of those assets which is difficult to have a pure play on. Livent has been it's a new listing of FMC Technologies lithium business, because lithium, FMC was one of the biggest producers, but lithium wasn't its biggest market. So Livent is now more of a pure play on lithium, and it has clearly broken out of the base formation put in this year. Then when we think about Orocobre, well, that's another pure play on lithium, and it looks a lot more like the lithium price overall, with that big downtrend down from the peak in 2018, and it has now clearly broken the sequence of lower rally highs. So it's another example as well of a share that had been on the cusp of breaking out before the pandemic. Then it got knocked for six and then has rebounded and is now pushing on and doing now what it looked like it was going to do back at the beginning of this year. So we're seeing that lithium prices and copper prices are doing better. Then if we think about the metal that has been most used in acid batteries, well, lead prices have rebounded, but not in nearly the same manner as some of the other industrial metals. What it instead suggests is that we're in still this very lengthy range that has been was started following the crash in 2008 and could persist for a lengthy period, and that the price could push back up towards $2,500, but we're going to have to see an additional demand driver. So if one is going to formulate a secular bull market hypothesis, then the potential is that it's going to be driven by copper and lithium, and that it is a battery story. Now, there's a good reason why places like China and Europe are most aggressive in pioneering the market for renewables. It's because when the USA was an energy importer, they didn't have to compete with the USA on energy because everybody was a major importer. Now that the USA is an exporter, they are at a significant geopolitical disadvantage. And that is particularly true when the USA has the world's largest navy and secures the global the security of global supply chains for the world's most vital commodity that it no longer needs. So they are definitely much more interested in renewables today than they were a decade ago. So it is very likely that we're going to have extremely high demand for investment in battery technology. Not only is it about green energy, not only is it about tackling pollution in various countries, particularly in China, but it's also about the geopolitical imperative of competing with the USA. So I think it is very likely that we are going to see significant demand for batteries. When we think then about the fact that contemporary Amperex is China's champion in terms of producing batteries, the share has continued to march higher, and it's still in a very consistent trend with a series of ranges one above another. Tesla has been by far the most successful company in the last decade at attracting capital. Elon Musk is really, I think, a certifiable genius, but his greatest talent is in attracting capital for his ventures. Now, when we think about the fact that in March, Tesla was trading below $100 and it is currently at $660, that is a phenomenal advance. Tesla's share price is doing better than Bitcoin, and that alone should be an alert to anyone that this is a highly speculative venture. What we are definitely starting to see is increasing interest from competitors. The one thing about battery-driven cars is that it opens up the way for interlopers. The number of moving parts within an electric vehicle is a fraction for that in an internal combustion engine. Therefore, the barrier to entry is really all about the battery and not much more than that. And if companies have access to batteries from an OEM producer like contemporary Amperex, then it's really cosmetic in terms of what they can do for developing their own cars. What, of course, the big game changer, therefore, is in the cost of production of batteries, because that's where competitive advantage comes in, and in technological innovation. Well, when it comes to battery cost compression, Tesla is certainly ahead. They have, during their battery day back in October, they announced a whole suite of incremental changes that will compress the price of their batteries by about 50% over the next few years. And that is part of the reason why the share price has rallied, that no one else is really doing that. But the important thing to realize about Tesla is that they open source all of their innovation. The company is really designed to try and pioneer a new electric vehicle global market. So while they're ahead in terms of their ability to provide the cheapest battery, they don't particularly have a model where they're trying to protect themselves. And then we have the odd situation that Toyota said last week that they have developed a solid-state battery and they anticipate bringing it to market next year. Now, this is an odd situation for a simple reason. Every company in the world that is involved in batteries and automotives is trying to develop the solid-state battery. Solid-state batteries charge extremely quickly from 0 to 100% in about 10 minutes. They generally have double the energy density of lithium-ion batteries, so the 500-mile range for an electric vehicle would be realizable easily. But then they also are much safer. So, because they have the solid element to instead of a liquid lithium, or well, they have the solid state battery is safer. I'm not going to get myself confused with trying to explain what it is. But the reality is they don't tend to last very long. So the recycling of the charge is not very effective. And one thing that we've seen from companies like Dyson, which had thought that they were able to solve this problem and ultimately failed, BMW, or any number of other companies, was that they were thinking they would have a solid-state battery in 2018 when they made the prediction in 2013. In 2018, they thought it would be 2020. In 2020, a lot of companies were still saying that they would have solid-state batteries in 2025. And as recently as July, that's exactly what Toyota said as well. But they said last week that they would have a vehicle ready for market in 2021. So the big question is Toyota serious? Have they, in fact, developed a new solid-state battery chemistry which is ready for production? Or are they jumping on the electric car bandwagon? The one encouraging point, I think, is that Toyota has been able to hold on better than other car manufacturers. If we look at, for example, Ford, it's been trending down for a decade. Even some of the better performing Chinese companies had been very quiet until this year. If we think about Volkswagen, then the share has been through the ringer in terms of the performance over the last year, with extraordinary bouts of volatility. All of them are now pricing in the potential for a rebound in terms of demand because of global reflation, and a similar rebound in terms of global activity like we saw in the period from 2008 through 2011. But will Toyota upend the entire market by bringing a solid-state battery vehicle to market in 2021? They were anticipating they would have a concept vehicle ready for the Olympics in Japan this year, and of course that was put on the back burner. So are they going to now be able to deliver, or are we going to have something come through from the much hyped QuantumScape? The company has also listed recently through a SPAC, and it is continuing to march higher, but they don't anticipate having their solid-state battery in the market for at least another 3 or 4 years. So this is a very significant rebound in terms of, hardly a rebound, but a very significant uptrend for a company that doesn't anticipating having a product in the market for years to come. But this is where the promise of technology really stands out, because what we're seeing right now is that commodity prices are doing better. We have the scope for technological innovation that could take what is a normal reflation and turn it into a secular bull market in terms of demand for a limited number of models, and likely to be pioneered by the countries that are coming out of the coronavirus in the best shape. If we go back then and think about the potential of a currency market index which has been going sideways for a decade, I think it's also worth keeping an eye on the other big commodity indices. So the Asia dollar index basically trended lower from 2011 until this year. It briefly exceeded the lows put in 2009 and has now clearly broken the downtrend. But the other point is that it was one of the most beautiful, consistent upward trends in the period from 2001 through to 2008 and subsequently on to 2011. When we then think about the Latin America dollar index, which is heavily weighted by the Brazilian real and the Mexican peso, it's also been trending downwards for all of this decade. But it also did really very well, and of course this massive devaluation that we had in the 1990s reflects just how weak the currencies were ahead of the rebound from 2002 through to 2007. But it also helps to highlight just how low Latin American currencies are right now, and the fact that they are, for the first time in at least 3 years, trading back above the trend mean. Of course, Mexico is also likely to be one of the countries that does best from the reshoring or nearshoring for the U.S. economy. And the Mexican peso has now strengthened briefly, at least through the 20 level, and rebounded really rather impressively. What I find interesting is that this trend for the Mexican peso looks really quite similar to the trend of underperformance by the South African rand, and the rand has strengthened through that psychological 15 level in here this week. So we're seeing increasing evidence of demand for commodity-related currencies. It's not just the Norwegian crown, but the Australian dollar has now also broken up and away from this first step above the V-bottom and is in back in a medium-term demand-dominated environment. This is also creating additional demand for industrial resources, and the ASX 300 Resources Index has now cleared the 5,000 level and is in the process of completing what is basically an 8-year base formation with a very large V between 2015 and 17. That's equally true for the performance of the FTSE 350 Mining Index, and it has also continued to push up and away from this base formation, and it's being led higher by some of the largest miners. Rio Tinto has been marketing itself as the miner for the new century, and its share price has certainly been rewarded. It's right back in the region of the peak from 2008, and while short-term overbought, this looks like a clear recovery candidate. So, as we look at what are likely to be the defining characteristics of the post-pandemic world, the countries that did best from the year of plague are likely to come out in a stronger position. That's really rather logical. The countries that have done it best are those that have dealt with these types of difficulties before. And we've seen, for example, that Taiwan's market has been resurgent and has clearly broken out of a 30-year base formation. The Korean market continues to push on to new high ground. The size of the rebound from the lows earlier this year is really quite profound, but the length of time it spent ranging prior to that is equally worthy of notice. The fact is that the market had spent years ranging after the peak in 1989. It broke out in 2005 and then went into another very lengthy range. It broke out in 2017, and then it had the hiatus of the pandemic and is now pushing on to new high ground. Then the other big market that is resurgent right now is Japan. And the Nikkei has clearly broken up and away from this first step above the base. Instead of being resistance, 20,000 is now an area of support, and this looks like a new recovery scenario. The big change now is that rather than the condition we've had over the last decade, what we're seeing right now is that emerging market and developed market currencies are doing well, and it is helping their stock markets. This is the complete opposite of what we had in 2010 through about 2018. Japan was heavily dependent on the currency market devaluation to support nominal price appreciation in the stock market. So was Europe, so was the UK. And the strength of the US dollar was fundamental to the demand for US assets. It was where growth and yield and performance were located, and it created demand for those assets and a strong currency. We're now in the exact opposite scenario. We're seeing that instead of prospering with a strong currency, over the last month, the USA has been dependent on a weak currency. So the S&P 500 is now a little weaker in here today. When we think about the dollar index, well, it's up a little in here today. So what investors are now doing is there is a carry going on, and there is the clear scope that the dollar is going to be a funding currency, it's going to be a funding mechanism for global carry trades. This is not something that we've seen before. There was a clear argument for using the euro as a funding mechanism for carry trades because of negative interest rates. There was a clear argument for using the yen as a funding currency for carry trades because the Bank of Japan was so active in devaluing the currency. But today what we have is some clear and increasingly credible evidence that investors are using the dollar as a funding mechanism for carry trades. And of course, what that means is that they're short dollars and then they get long of everything else. It also means that when the dollar rebounds, it creates a knock-on effect in everything else. But it's most likely to have an effect on the domestic stock market. And I think that that is increasingly what we're seeing right now. The NASDAQ 100 has closed today is about to close in about 10 minutes with a downside key reversal. Now, it's a small one, and it doesn't have the kind of dynamic impact that would really stand out on the chart. But it's not the first time that we've had a downside key. We had another one in November, and that was right in the region of the upper side of the range. We had another one in July. It was a downside key reversal. We didn't have any follow-through. But these are stabs on the downside. Not every downward dynamic is a key reversal. Certainly the one that we had recently wasn't. But we've had a very inert period of trading. The breakout to new highs has not resulted in a wave of new buying. So we are at the point where we have to conclude that some stops have probably been put in the NASDAQ somewhere around 12,200. That's the upper side of the underlying range. It's the region of the most recent low. There's obviously potential that if that level breaks, then 12,000 becomes the next level. If 12,000 breaks, well, then there's the potential that it's going to come back down and test the region of the trend mean. The Dow Jones is another example where we've had this incredibly inert period of trading. Yes, the price has pushed on to new highs, and it is right in the region of this psychological 30,000 level. But we can also see that the breakouts have been failing. There is still the sequence of higher reaction lows. So this wedgy characteristic, and it is very small and very short term in nature, it really holds out the potential that if we do get an additional dollar rally, and the dollar is very oversold in the short term, despite the fact that the medium to long term is clearly negative for the dollar, in the short term it's oversold. So if the dollar rebounds, it's likely to take a chunk out of the performance of the stock market, and the stock market is overbought in the short term. The cyclicality of the trend in the dollar index is, I think, one of the most important factors to pay attention to. When we go back and look at history, it is almost biblical in nature. So we've had this 7-year trend on the upside from approximately 1978 all the way through to the peak in 1985. We had a peak in 1969 and a low in 1978. So that was a longer downtrend of about 9 years. The peak in 1978 or 1985 bottomed in 1992, so a 7-year downtrend. The low in 1992 peaked in 2001. So this was a somewhat lengthier advance, about 9 years. Although, arguably, if we wanted to use the 1995 low, then it's a 7-year advance. So we've had 7-year uptrends on average, 7-year downtrends on average. We had another low in 2008. We've had another peak in 2016. Well, if that's what we're looking at, then the rationale for being bullish of the dollar in this period from 2017 all the way through until 2019 was fiscal tightening. Excuse me, quantitative tightening. The Federal Reserve was taking dollars out of supply. Well, they're not doing that anymore. Rather, the opposite. The interest rate differential that the US dollar enjoyed is gone. And the fiscal deficit is expanding at an alarming rate. They anticipate having an additional $10 trillion of debt within the next decade. The Social Security Administration is going to be at a point in 2021 where the money being taken in is not enough to pay out on the claims. So it will start cutting into its savings. All of that is negative for the dollar. So yes, it is oversold in the short term, and we could have a rebound in the short term as it comes back into the region of the lower side of this range. But we can also think about the cyclicality of the dollar index, that it tends to have these big moves. And we're at a major turning point potentially where the dollar could trend lower for anything up to 5 or 6 and more years. And with a sequence of lower highs and lower lows, the clear conclusion is that if we do see it breaking down below the lows put in 2018 at some point in the next couple of quarters, then over the course of the next 4 or 5 years, it would be logical to anticipate the dollar will decline all the way down to new lows. Well, that would be bullish for the stock market in nominal terms, but it would be a clear argument for why emerging markets should do way better. Because when investors get really interested in other markets, is when they have the currency on their side. If we're looking at a massive reflation effort over the next few years against a background of a weak dollar and the potential for a significant demand growth driver coming through from the renewables sector, whether it is an effort to massively build out renewable energy generation capacity, or whether it is the rollout of electric vehicles or solid-state batteries, it represents a potentially secular bull market in terms of demand for copper and other battery metals. Of course, if we're thinking about what those battery metals are, I should have mentioned nickel as well. And nickel prices are coming off of very depressed levels. So we are potentially at a massive turning point for the markets, where the question of debt is going to become much more pressing if the dollar continues to trend lower, because it will drag interest rates higher. the devaluation of the dollar, the question about debt, and the need to preserve one's purchasing power continues to support the argument for gold. And gold prices have rebounded now from the region of the trend mean. This has been a reasonably orderly consolidation in the region of the previous peak. We've had a meaningful rebound over the course of this month. It has not yet quite broken the downward bias, so it still has work to do, but it's hard to argue with the medium-term bullish argument that gold represents a hard asset that cannot simply be printed into existence, that we're likely to have negative real interest rates for the foreseeable future, and that is the most benign environment overall for gold. The kinds of factors that have limited the price performance of late are more than likely transitory. The fact that net central bank buying was negative for one quarter is unlikely to be repeated, and certainly not on a regular basis. ETF selling of gold is also unlikely to be a very significant factor. In fact, as we look at the size of the pullback, it's only in the region of about 4%. So relative to the size of the decline we've seen in gold, the selling of ETF holdings has not been all that large, and it is coming back into the region of the trend mean. And CTA funds are now approaching a net short position, and that's generally a contrary indicator. So the situation is lining up for gold miners to be rather attractive. The sector was in negative territory today, but it is steadying from the region of the trend mean. It's certainly on a recovery trajectory, coming from depressed levels, but it's in the ideal position today that gold miners overall have been investing less in new supply. They have been concentrating on maintaining free cash flow, on increasing dividends, and really just doing the best they can in terms of good governance. When we look at the longer history that's available for the Gold Bugs Index, we can also see that the 200 point level has generally been an area of resistance in the decade before the big bull market and support since. And there is clear potential that gold shares are going to prosper in an environment where we have a clear desire for lower interest rates, for money printing, and the potential that people will want to have some form of hedge against the devaluation of the money in their pockets. As we look at the 10-year government bond yield, it has held this incremental progression of higher reaction lows for the last 5 months, and it was slightly higher again in here today. Eventually, we're going to see that the weakness of the dollar is going to drag yields higher, because why would anyone want to buy bonds when there are better yield opportunities elsewhere? As countries around the world begin to raise interest rates, the relative value proposition for investing in the USA will become much less convincing. And that's very similar to what happened in the early 2000s. Back then, it needed the demand growth driver of China entering the WTO. On this occasion, it may be the energy transfer. It might be early to make that determination, and we will need to see substantive efforts to spend the money necessary to pioneer that change, but the charts are certainly pointing in that direction. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.